who is holds the chair of Hispanic Ministries as a member of the executive staff of the Board for Missions of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. In addition to that, he's a good friend of mine, and he even teaches me a word or two of Spanish, and I know he likes me when he calls me Ricardo. And I told my wife that, and she didn't recognize the name. I've asked him to share with you and to sensitize you to the challenges and the problems. And thereafter, we're going to invite some of the men who vicared in Hispanic ministry last year to share some of their feelings and experiences. And then I think there will be time enough for you to ask questions or to make comments. So, Pastor Puig, would you please take the mic, please?
Thank you, Ricardo. I appreciate the comments. I have brought with me a few things that I hope will be of some help. During the last convention, I had to prepare a brochure to be distributed among the visitors, and I still have a few left in the office. I didn't know how many people we were going to have here, so I just brought a few. Perhaps whoever happens to end up with one of them, good luck to you, and who does not, if you're interested, please let me know. I'll be very happy to get some of these to you. I would like to pass them out right now because, and maybe you can look over the other guy's shoulder, but I'm going to be talking about some of these items, particularly the map that you find in the back of that brochure. But to set the tone, I would like to begin by sort of clarifying a few points. Number one, that we are all committed to the Lord Jesus Christ and His church, and that this commitment is a three-level commitment. Number one, commitment to Christ Himself. Number two, commitment to His church. And number three, commitment to His work. And I think that pretty well takes care of what we are and why we are here. I don't believe that anybody can argue with any of these. My main point, however, is that without these, then we are in trouble regardless of what kind of ministry we go into. It doesn't matter whether it's Hispanic or Chinese or Korean or if it is to the Anglo community or the German ethnic group that the Lutheran Church has been all along. It doesn't make any difference. And it is also important to realize that this is sort of a tiered cake. The commitment to Christ must be first. Commitment to God and His Christ must be the base, because here is where the power lies for us to get our work done. And then, in order, and we dare not twist them around, by the way, the commitment to His church must be next. It is very interesting that the Bible very clearly throughout the whole thing very clearly states that this one relationship that we have with God in Christ is to manifest itself in a relationship to that we have to each other, a relationship of love. And this then is what becomes the Holy Christian Church, that we love one another as Christ has loved us. The last tier on that cake then becomes the work that we do for Christ, for His church. I find that very often we tend to confuse the second and the third, and we do not seem to pay too much attention to the love relationship that must exist. And instead, we get very busy at doing the work of the church. And then the congregation begins to fall apart. The pastor and the congregation become polarized, or we begin to have difficulties because the elders think one way and the stewardship committee thinks a different way. And we wonder why. I have no doubts that they are Christian. I have no doubts that they mean well. But I think that somewhere along the line, we have not nurtured that love that the Lord has asked us to share. So, what I'm talking about then, and I would like for you to keep in mind, is that even if you do not go into Hispanic ministry, keep in mind that there are priorities, and that the priorities have a certain order which cannot be changed. In dealing with the minorities, here again, that second priority, that love that we are to reflect, becomes extremely important. We do not dare assume that we have, because we have worked on the first two priorities, that we should forget the last one any more than we should forget any of them. Because the Christian, to be a Christian, means to be involved in all three. The last one, however, the one that deals with the work of the church and with all the other priorities that the Christian has in his life, gets its power from the relationship that the individual has to Christ and the sensitivity that a person has for working with minorities, and this is what we came to hear about, stems just from that one relationship to God and his Christ. I would like to read a couple of quotations for you before we start talking about Hispanic ministry. Both of them are from the same book, a familiar writer by the name of Helmut Tillich, and what to me is a really a beautiful book, The Waiting Father. He says, a person who cannot wholeheartedly rejoice with God when the icy crust about a torpid, empty heart begins to thaw, a person who is not himself inflamed by the glowing love of Jesus for the erring and the lost, and is not impelled to rescue human souls, that person is alienating himself from God in a very subtle but dreadful way. No matter how consciously and determinedly he continues to dwell with him, even though he prays and reads the Bible and goes to church. In other words, the first two levels, the first two priorities, without the third one, do not amount to too much, really. This other quotation that I have is also from the same book, and he writes, a Christian who is only quiet, a Christian who keeps his mouth shut about what has been bestowed on him, a Christian whose nature and acts, whose laughter and comradeship do not show it, is, I beg your pardon for using the expression, but it expresses the thing so precisely that I do not dare allow mere pulpit politeness to permit me to use it, is nothing but a dud. He is dynamite that fails to go off. I think both of these are very true, are very accurate. And I think that we do very well to keep them in mind, because the Lord has asked us to go and make disciples. He has asked us to go and teach what he has commanded. But in that great commission, when he said, go and make disciples of all nations, he said all nations. And I don't know of anybody that could possibly misunderstand those words. We are not talking about addressing ourselves to one ethnic group, but to all nations. We're not talking about addressing ourselves about one social level or strata in society. We're talking about all peoples. I do not believe that the Lord intended for us to address ourselves to one economic level in our society. He said all people, from all nations. Then when we begin to think that way, we begin to realize that our obligation goes a lot further beyond our own type of people, that we do have to reach out. And I also believe that the Lord meant to go a lot further than just putting your hand in your pocket and coming out with a $5 bill and turning it all over to missions, for someone else to do the job. I don't think that that's what he intended. As a matter of fact, I'm sure that that's not what he intended. So what I'm asking you then is to think about these things and think about the commitment that you are making when you say, yes, Lord, I want to be a pastor in your church. Because you are going to be the one that is going to be looked upon to do the leading. The flock that you become responsible for is to follow you. And what you believe, the priorities that you hold, and the way in which you carry out whatever goals you might have to achieve, you know, those priorities, the flock will follow. All right. As far as Hispanic ministry is concerned, I'm sure all of you have been hearing about it. I am sure all of you have known that for some time now, it has been the girlfriend, I guess, or the first love of our synod. I do not know for how long. I have no idea how long it will take our synodical structure to find some other project and that it will divert its attention to this new love. But at least for the time being, this is it. We are concerned about the ministries to the minorities. We realize that for the last 137 or 140 years, or however long it has been since the synod was organized, that we have missed the boat. For 55 years, we have been working among the Hispanics in this country. And in 55 years, we have very little to show for it. Thank God that at least now we are realizing that somehow or other we must address ourselves to this, and thank God for the fact that the church has waken up and has realized that we need to prepare men if we are to go and make disciples. As far as the population itself in our country today, we have in the neighborhood of 20 million Hispanics, and out of these, of course, you will find that there is great difference in their cultural background. Within this one culture, there are a number of subcultures which need to be looked at very closely and of which we need to be very much aware lest we put our foot in our mouth. The Cuban is not like the Mexican. The Puerto Rican is not like the Guatemalteco. There is no way. We have, like I say, various subcultures. The language ties them together. But we must be aware of the fact that they are not identical. And this then, as we prepare ourselves to serve them, alerts us to the fact that this preparation goes a lot deeper than just the theological education that we receive at the seminaries. We have to have some anthropology. We have to have some culture studies. We have to have some sensitivity developed in us so that when we meet these people, we accept them for what they are and where they are, and then, by the grace of God and through His gospel, try to lift them up and bring them closer to the Lord. I said before that we have about 20 million Hispanics in our country today. If you will look at the map, and those of you that don't have one, please, maybe you can look at over somebody's shoulder. If you look at the map, in there you will find that each state has a figure. That is the number of Hispanics that are residing in that state. As of the last figures, these are the last figures that Uncle Sam gave us. I am sure that with the 1980 census, these things are going to change quite a bit. But at least this is what we have to work with now. And if you will be so kind to look at the lower left-hand corner, you see that even Hawaii, as far away as they are, has something like 28,000 Hispanics. I've been trying to get my boss to send me to Hawaii because it is part of the Northern California, Nevada, Hawaii district, but he won't let me. He says if anybody goes to Hawaii, he goes to Hawaii. So, but anyhow, some of these figures are truly staggering. We're talking 2.5 million in Texas, and I'm sure Texas can house perhaps another 2.5 million very easily. They got plenty of space down there. California, 3,348,000. Most of them in Los Angeles. Washington State. We don't even think about Washington State. 74,000. Do you believe that? If you go out to the East Coast, you'd really be shocked because Massachusetts has 89,000. And I don't even know that we have a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation in Massachusetts. I'm sure we do, but, you know, don't hear very much about it. Even Maine, 4,000. The point that I'm trying to make is that I don't care where you go, you are going to run across Spanish-speaking people. And these are going to be people that, because of their cultural background, are going to have to be dealt with in an entirely different way from what we are accustomed to. The traditional way of speaking and reaching out to people doesn't work very well. We have to take into consideration the fact that traditionally they think of themselves as being Roman Catholics. That, for one, is enough to throw anybody for a loop. Not that they are, because statistically, over 70% of them have no church affiliation at all. But they think of themselves as being Roman Catholic. When you come from a nationality or a number of countries that have had the Roman Catholic Church as the dominant church for over 400 years, you can't think otherwise. So that is a barrier that has to be knocked down. And then, in addition to that, all the other things that go along with it. For example, the saint worship, Mariology, even the spiritism and all the other little kinky things that are allowed, they all have to be torn down, and a person has to actually start from scratch. So it takes a lot of know-how. Know-how that, believe it or not, you are not going to get here at the SEM unless we bring somebody in to do the teaching. I am sure that the same thing applies to our Korean brothers, as to our Chinese brothers, and all the other minorities that we have. It is something that we have to realize if we are serious about going out and making disciples of all nations. Then we have to realize that we have to provide the wherewithal. We have to train our men in ways in which they can cope with other kinds of people. If you look at the map, I have been having some problems with it because I left some information out which I should have put in, and that is the location of the various congregations that we have today in Hispanic ministry. When I came to 500 last April the 1st, we had 35 congregations or preaching stations that were working in Hispanic ministry. Today the total is 42. And for that we thank God, because His is the glory and the power and everything else, and whatever we do simply because He provides the means, believe me. California, the Los Angeles area, about 3 months ago went on record saying that they would like to start 6 new congregations. 6! In the greater Los Angeles area. Now that is a commitment from the mission board and the board of directors of the district. We need men to fill those positions. Up in Washington State, in Oregon, we have enough people to get something going up there. So far, we have only been able to provide one individual, so we have one congregation, one worker, let's put it that way. Up in, what's the name of the place? Yakima Valley. Pastor Brandt. In San Francisco, we have a man that just finished last year, Mireles. He was assigned to, not San Francisco, but Sacramento. And he is just beginning to work among the Hispanics in that area. Texas, that's an old hat. Our first congregation was there 55 years ago, and today we have about 17 congregations in Texas. We could double that tomorrow if we had the manpower. And hear me clearly when I say if we have the manpower. I am not concerned about the money. The Lord provides that very, very easily. Today we could very easily start 10 new ones if we had the people. I'm serious about that. But anyhow, Texas has 17 and they could have 30 or 35 or 40 very, very easily. Florida right now has 4 congregations, 1 in Tampa, 3 in Miami, and they are looking forward to opening another one in Orlando. Going up the coast, New York and New Jersey, they have a total of 8 congregations. They could use 10 more very easily. When you consider the population, then you realize that it wouldn't be difficult. 1,440,000 in New York alone, 384,000 in New Jersey. The Midwest, the Chicago area, has 8 congregations. In Cleveland, in Indiana, in Illinois, in Wisconsin, and in Minnesota. The rest of the country is empty. Got plenty of space. Plenty of room, believe me. But the Lord has been very good to us. As of the last convention, we said that we would like to see 50 new congregations and 100 new pastors in the field by the end of the 80s. So far, we are ahead of schedule, and we thank God for that. But we dare not go to sleep. So, as of right now, anybody that cares to volunteer to fill a vicarage or to go out on Hispanic ministry, I can put him to work. I have 10 openings right now, believe it or not. 6 in California, 1 in Phoenix, 1 in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Beautiful. Well, oh, that's a gorgeous place. I was tempted to take that one myself. 1 in Denver, New Orleans, Florida, in Orlando, like I said, Washington, D.C., New York City would like to start about 3 new ones right now. I don't know where they get the money. We would have to provide it because the district itself doesn't have it. But I'm sure that we could get grants and whatnot to do it. But they would like to start 3 if we can get the personnel. And, of course, Indiana would like to start 1 up by the lake on the northern side of Indiana. Wisconsin is in need of all places, starting a congregation up in Sheboygan, believe it or not. Among all those Germans. But that's a fact. That's no joke. That's a fact. And Illinois would like to start 2 more in addition to what they already have. They have 1 going in Streeter, and they are in the process of reshuffling their pastors in order to fill in so that they can handle as many as they possibly can. So, we have the goals for you. The challenge is there. And the commitment is also there. I can't speak about the district, but I can talk about the synod. And we are committed 100%. We are committed to assist the individual that desires to go into minority ministries, and I'm not just saying Hispanic this time, to help them with their preparation through scholarships, whatever. We are committed to help the districts to plant new churches, to open preaching stations. We are committed to finding the necessary funds to do just that. And we are also committed to utilize whatever resources the Lord has given us, such as Lutheran Brotherhood, etc., to utilize those funds to expand the ministry to the minorities and to do the best we can to carry out His great commission to go and make disciples of all nations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pastor Puig. We're grateful for this insight. Exciting things are happening. We like to keep you informed. We're striving now, I guess, still with the immigration authorities. We have a man up in Western Canada who has had all of his theological education in Spain and who has done advanced work. He has a master's degree from Princeton Theological Seminary, and who will be on campus as soon as we can get him here, I guess, to do a simultaneous colloquy and PhD. We're delighted at that, to get some advanced theological leadership into this ministry. We just heard the other day of a man in the New York area who is in a similar position, and that's good. We need soldiers out in the field, and ultimately we're going to need men on the theological campuses who can trained for this ministry. In addition, you should know a little bit about the Chicago Hispanic Colloquy Center. It's an unusual situation. We have four men who meet on the campus at Concordia College in River Forest, and none of whom speaks English or speaks it well enough or understands it well enough presently to participate in our theological training on this campus. And therefore, we provide on that campus the basic program which you get, exegesis, hermeneutics, homiletics, the whole works, worship, in the Spanish language. Pastor Juan Martin does quite a bit of the teaching, and Professor Dr. Herbert Sims, who has been involved in this ministry for many, many years now, and others, Professor Garcia from the Fort Wayne campus, who runs over occasionally. The arrangement is that these men enroll in one or the other of the seminaries. Presently, we have a man named Esaul Salomon, who's a very bright young man who has worked extensively with the Bible societies and has done a lot of work in getting the Bible out in the Spanish language, who is enrolled here. He is counted among our student body. The other three are presently enrolled at Fort Wayne, but most of their work will be done on that campus. We're still struggling to get some of the courses in the videotape with a Spanish language overlay. So there are a lot of things that are presently going on. We're very happy that the Lord is blessing us. Now, I'd like to have a few moments spent with some of the men who last year spent their year in Hispanic ministry and vicarage. And Mike, I think I'll turn this section over to you. You share it as you see fit. We'll make you the Master of Ceremonies for a minute. Mike Snow.
I was hoping I wouldn't have to be the first one to speak because I don't know what I'm going to say. It's Hispanic vicarage is challenging. It's probably one of the more difficult things that you can get yourself into, but it's probably one of the areas of greatest reward that you could ever work in. I've vicared in Del Rio, Texas, which is 3 miles from Ciudad Acuña, and worked out of Grace Lutheran Church there. Dave will tell you about his later on. He was the closest vicar to me. He was 350 miles away. Del Rio has a population of 20,000. Grace Lutheran Church runs about, I would say, 50 to 60 Anglo families in membership. And the Spanish-speaking or the Mexican-American membership, when I left, consisted of approximately 5 families. We did our language training in Austin, Texas, under Dr. Fred Grocock. And since I'm married, my wife is somewhat upset about this as to what was she going to do when she went down there and she couldn't speak Spanish. And they were nice enough to take care of that problem for her. She also took the language training with us. And so for those of you who are married, don't let that stop you, because I am sure if they continue in the way that they have been, that they will take care of your wife for you also. And if your wives are like mine, she'll learn much more than you do a lot faster. It's challenging in the fact that everything that you would do as a vicar in an English-speaking congregation, well, you have to do it twice. You have to be able to do it in English, and you have to be able to do it in Spanish. When you answer the telephone at the church, you have to be able to either answer in Spanish or English, depending on who's on the other end of the phone. When you do door-to-door evangelism, you listen outside the doors to try to give you a key as to what the individual will be speaking when they come to the door. If you hear a English radio station, well, you stand a pretty good chance of having an individual who speaks English answer the door. The mission outreach opportunities are fantastic. They are beautiful. I can honestly say in the year that I spent on vicarage that I have never encountered a more loving and more cooperative people than the Mexican Americans are. They are truly beautiful people. Truly beautiful. They have a respect for the pastoral office that's almost unheard of. You know, you feel like a priest or something when you walk in the room, because what you say, they listen to. You are God's representative to them. I don't care if you're a vicar or if you're the pastor or what. You represent God, and they respect you for that. Once you had them as your friends, you couldn't ask for anyone who will work any harder for you. It was, I don't want to spend too much time for it, it was a tremendous experience. I have a lot of real good memories, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, I'll be honest with you. There were times during the vicarage when I did ask myself, what in the world am I doing here? And then there's other times toward the end when I just thank God for the fact that He did give me the chance to work with these people. Each vicarage situation is different. Each state is different. Each set of circumstances is different. This population growth, as I look at this in Texas, being a Texan, there in Del Rio, I had a couple of friends that were members of the Anglo congregation that worked for the Border Patrol. And just to show you how rapidly this is growing, in Del Rio alone, one city, they would capture 1,500 illegal aliens each month. And it was estimated that for each one that they caught, three came into the United States that they would never see again. And these are people that you have to, these are the people that need to be ministered to. It's a whole different set of circumstances. A lot of them don't even understand the Lutheran liturgy. We had to shift to using the guitar or a piano. We had our greatest success with home Bible studies over and above the Sunday morning worship, because if they turn from Catholicism, any association with a church building, now this is in our particular area, it differs all up and down the border and in different states. In our particular area, if you were in a church building, they would try to link you to Catholicism somehow. So if you could go to a home, whereas I was all excited when I heard in Austin I was going to Del Rio, and I heard that there had been two previous vicars down there and that things were on fire. And so when I got to Del Rio, I was expecting things to be on fire. Well, by those standards, they were. We must have had 9 people in the first worship service. And, you know, at first you feel somewhat silly, but then you realize, hey, these people are tearing away from their whole family. They're tearing away from everything they've been taught, and they're here. Now, we'd have one of our more successful home Bible studies, we might have as many as 20 people in the home. And they were just, you know, really cooperative. I'm going to let some of the other guys talk about, you know, the different aspects down in McAllen and Dennis is in Florida. One of our brothers, Gary Rokenbroek, we just received a letter from him. He is taking a 2-year Hispanic vicarage, and he is in Harlingen, Texas at this time, and he is still very excited. It's challenging. It's rewarding. It is different from anything you will ever do. Each day you learn. They are a very, 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 our Mexican brothers and sisters are very, very loving. And the thing for us to remember is the fact they are our brothers and sisters in Christ. They have a great, great, great need. And if we don't fill it, I don't know how they're going to get it. In the Del Rio area, the largest church there is Assembly of God. And they're on fire. They average 300 to 400 people in each of their worship services that meet 3 times a week. They're there. The ministry's there. So if you have even the slightest inkling along these lines, do it. Because I don't think anyone would regret it. Even if you had some doubts, I'd say go ahead and take a Hispanic vicarage. It'll really, really make you appreciate the gospel message that you're proclaiming. It will really let you see before your very eyes what the gospel can do for these people. It's a beautiful experience. Dave?
You know, there's one thing that scares a lot of people, and that's the fact you have to speak in another language. Now, I normally have trouble just speaking English. Now, to get myself into Spanish was really a challenge. And it's something you can do, because if you let a language scare you and let it be a barrier, it's going to prevent the gospel from being heard by such a large amount of people. And that really is a shame. I wasn't the most prolific vicar they ever had in their native tongue. In fact, from my experience for at least half the vicarage, I'd be preaching sermons mainly looking at the pulpit and no place else. But with some people it takes a little longer time than others, but you learn. And you learn because, like Mike says, these people have such a heart and they're encouraging. They understand who you are. They understand the difficulties you have. But I think it's something where you have to put your pride aside and your image of yourself aside and care about them and about their souls and about where they're going and put that as the priority. And then you can get into it. I ended up, by the time I finished vicarage, I was in a different type of situation than Mike. I think El Buen Pastor McAllen is one of the largest Hispanic churches in Sinnott. We had a school situation, and by the end of the year, I wasn't only preaching and teaching Bible class in Spanish, but I was teaching sixth grade religion as well as science in the Spanish language. I won't say it went very fast, but I'd say I was enjoying it. I think the kids were enjoying it, and there was a lot to learn. And that's one thing I encourage you to think about. Don't let the language or anything else scare you, but put Christ first, because these people need you. It's like what Gary wrote in his letter to us. It's like really facing the Reformation all over again, because you're really meeting Catholics where they're at. And if there's any church that can really address them, I would imagine it's the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And I just encourage you not to let anything stand in your way, but to go forth and preach the gospel in its truth and purity.
I guess I had a totally different situation than either of these two. I was in Miami, which is predominantly Cuban. I think it's just about 90% Cuban. And then they have a lot of representation from South America, a lot of South Americans moving up that way. I guess the question I receive most often is, how did you learn your Spanish? And I think that was a major concern. They have a summer language program, which I unfortunately was not able to take. So the summer before I went down, I had very little background in Spanish, a couple of high school years, but you know how high school languages go. And I lived with a bunch of Mexicans that are at the Missouri Synod Mission in St. Paul, Minnesota, and tried to pick up as much Spanish as I could during the evenings, and then just went down to Miami with a limited Spanish and lived with the people. And it is very surprising how, if you're using it every day, how rapidly it comes and how you're able to carry on a conversation.
Well, I guess I had a totally different situation than either of these two. I was in Miami, which is predominantly Cuban. I think it's just about 90% Cuban. And then they have a lot of representation from South America, a lot of South Americans moving up that way. I guess the question I receive most often is, how did you learn your Spanish? And I think that was a major concern. They have a summer language program, which I unfortunately was not able to take. So the summer before I went down, I had very little background in Spanish, a couple of high school years, but you know how high school languages go. And I lived with a bunch of Mexicans that are at the Missouri Synod Mission in St. Paul, Minnesota, and tried to pick up as much Spanish as I could during the evenings, and then just went down to Miami with a limited Spanish and lived with the people. And it is very surprising how, if you're using it every day, how rapidly it comes and how you're able to carry on a conversation with a limited vocabulary, to be sure, and with a lot of literal expressions, thinking a translation in English. But it got towards the end that I could think in a language.
So to me, I would say right now, if I were to be thinking about a Hispanic vicarage, the learning of the language, while it is a major concern, wouldn't be a major barrier to me anymore. About Miami, it's an example of one of the towns in America that is changing very rapidly. In 1960, there were very few Hispanics living in Miami, and then Castro took over, and the exodus started pouring in, so that now the majority population in the Miami area, Dade County area, is Hispanic. The Hispanics living in Miami are somewhat middle class. They're buying homes, becoming presidents of banks. They're pretty much getting into the mainstream of American middle class wealth. So it's a somewhat different situation than a lot of Hispanic ministries. Our church missions down there are growing quite rapidly. Where I was at in Hialeah, which is a suburb of Miami, kind of like Clayton and St. Louis, it's about 70% Hispanic now. And our church grew by 37 adults last year. So the vicarage included a lot of confirmation instruction in Spanish. I preached every third Sunday, every three Sundays I would preach, and then some in the other churches in Miami. The thing that impressed me most about the vicarage was the reception of the people. I was really scared going down there that I just was gonna flop terribly. I even had visions of doing second and third year vicarages. But I was just surprised at how the people received me and how helpful they were and how they would take me into their homes and help me with the language in a very, very loving way. I think that's one of the most beautiful experiences of my whole life, was the love and acceptance and the help shown to me by these Spanish Christians down there. I lived in an apartment complex in the edge of what's called Little Havana in Miami, and I was the only Anglo in that apartment complex. And so that was an additional way that I was almost forced to learn Spanish. And I think it was the best experience of my life, even though it was challenging to pick up a language and a culture. It was just so rewarding to be able to see the power of the Holy Spirit working through a clay vessel such as yourself, operating in a completely different medium, getting the gospel across in a different language. And so I too would encourage any who are just thinking about it. I kind of went down with the idea, well, this will be nice for a year and I don't know if it'll work out, kind of that kind of attitude, like, I don't know if this is really right for me, to an attitude of really loving the ministry more and more as the year progressed. So I would encourage any of you who are considering Hispanic vicarages to pursue it. And it won't be easy, actually, to get a Hispanic vicarage. The placement people, as I recall, we had like 6 or 7 meetings with them, and each time they kept asking you, are you sure you want to do it? Are you sure you want to do it? So they'll put you through a process where you think through it quite a bit before you actually make that decision, thinking through all of the angles and everything on it.
This is testimonial time. Anybody else want to give a testimony? I guess Mr. Garcia is not here yet. He's planning to stop in later. He got... Oh, he was. He left already. I think it helps probably if you eat tortillas in some form or other 3 times a day. I think you'll learn to speak Spanish more quickly then. You'll stay away from those margaritas. Okay, we will open this up. I'd like to ask Pastor Puig a question that I think is important for all of us, and then we'll open it up. In terms of most Hispanics or Latinos coming out of a Roman Catholic culture, if not really the Roman Catholic religion, the question is, how does that affect your work with them? And to what extent are there adjustments necessary in such things as liturgy or ritual and so on? I guess what I'm asking basically is, what is the Roman Catholicism of these people like, first of all?
I mentioned before that their church affiliation was, if anything, was very nominal. As far as the liturgy is concerned, at least my experience was that there was no problem. they are used to a liturgical church, because whenever they do go to church, they've been going to the Catholic Church, which is a rather high liturgical church. So there is no problem in that area. There is room for, you know, experimenting. Like you might want to use a guitar, you might want to bring in some of the native hymns. There are some of those, you know. But for the most part, I had no difficulty at all. The group that I had in Racine, they, using the Spanish hymnal, they learned the liturgy for the main worship service with communion. They sang the responses, no trouble at all. They also learned matins, and they also learned vespers. We had no problems at all. I used to chant, they used to answer back. You know, it's no problem, it was great. I never had to really worry too much about going out of the hymnal to find what I needed, because they were very comfortable with it. I believe they knew just about every hymn in that hymnal, because I made it my business to teach it to them. They have to be taught, because nobody is born knowing, but it's no problem. As far as I'm concerned, there is no problem there. My biggest problem was in the area of weaning them away from Roman Catholic ideas. Okay. And getting them into the Bible and getting them to learn that what God says is not necessarily what the Catholic Church has been teaching all along. That was my biggest problem. So somebody mentioned, Mike, I think you mentioned the fact that Bible studies are very strong. They enjoy them tremendously. I had a lot of success with Bible study. And the people themselves became very strong Christians as far as their biblical knowledge is concerned and as far as their own Lutheranism is concerned, because I did not limit myself to the Bible. I also went to the confessions. The group that I had in Racine went through the Augsburg Confession. They went through the Apology. They also studied the Large Catechism. And they became very knowledgeable, which is what helps them then to counteract, you know, the offense that is made, or offense, that's the wrong word, in thinking in terms of Spanish and translating into English. That happens once in a while. The attacks that are made from the other camp. You know, like was mentioned before, that these people, many instances, they have to give up their family. They have to give up many, many things. And, of course, the family continues to pressure and so on and so forth, and they need something to counteract that. And, of course, the gospel itself is very badly needed, because that's where they are going to have their strength and their comfort. And that is what's going to make the whole thing worthwhile. So, primarily, I would say, is their Roman Catholic background and ideas and so on and so forth that have to be torn down so that then you can start from scratch.
Okay. Questions? Comments? I'd like to ask this of either you, Pastor Craig, or Mike or Dennis or anyone else in the room who's had experience in an ethnically mixed congregation. We've heard some people say that that's not the best way to reach minorities, that you just let yourself in for potential problems with prejudice on both sides. Do you feel that's valid? And if not, do you feel there are particular adjustments that need to be made in the way that you reach out to people who are not, traditional Anglo Lutheran? Some of them have been touched on.
Mm-hmm. Mike, do you want to? Maybe not.
Turn off the tape recorders and everything. In all honesty, I will have to admit that we had large problems in our congregation with that. In the Del Rio community, which is 85-90% Mexican, this is the biggest problem. The Anglo congregation expresses a desire to serve the people, but they don't want to do it. They want you to do it for them. They say that they want these people involved in their church, yet every time the people try to get involved, they do something to turn them away. Every program, well, every voters' assembly I went to, we did not have any of the Mexican American members at the voters' assembly. And it's always this thing, I'm sure that Pastor Puig can tell you, it's always this thing, the we, they. Maybe it would just depend on the area of the country. Maybe the fact that I was in a small West Texas town where they had grown up with a prejudice that they are striving to overcome the prejudice, but when it's been instilled for hundreds of years, and all of a sudden you find yourself as an Anglo as the minority, and everything is, you know, being controlled in the school systems are, you know, just unbelievable as far as, you know, the Anglo minority, then sometimes you can, even though they're trying so hard, they just can't overcome the prejudice, you know, at this point. It's my opinion, for what that's worth, that in this particular area, this particular situation, that a Hispanic missionary at large to open a Hispanic congregation would be more successful. That is, you know, in this particular situation, I...
Well, I had a different situation for the fact that I had no Hispanic congregation. There's two churches in town, one Hispanic and one English. I didn't understand it at times, and neither did some of the other pastors in the circuit, why the Hispanics and the Anglos couldn't get together. But it was a problem. I had talked with my supervisor, and he had said he had strong Anglos at times in the church. But he would always send them over so that they wouldn't dominate and so that his people could grow and mature and take responsibilities, which he thought was a major concern. The language became a factor because we had second and third generation Hispanics and they were catching on to English and weren't leaving the mother tongue but sort of relegated to a lesser importance. And therefore, from that aspect, there was conflicts in the church due to language services. So those things do develop. Dennis, I know, has opinions on that.
I don't know, I think it can work. Where I was at in Hialeah, that particular congregation, there was a lot of harmony between the two groups. They worshipped in the same place. They were structurally part of the same organization. They called themselves one church, worshipping in two languages. The congregation ethnically was divided about half and half, although there would be like about 50 more people attending English functions and services, but a lot of those were Hispanics that had given up Spanish in favor of English. And there was quite a bit of harmony between the two groups. Each month there was an activity, a dinner, or some activity that would get both groups together. The Spanish would have kind of their umbrella organization, their own evangelism committee, their own elders committee, their own ushers committee. But the two groups got along in that congregation pretty well. There was a lot of Anglo prejudice in Miami that, I don't really know prejudice, no, no, opinion that the Hispanics moving to this country should learn English. And that was pretty much generally accepted in our English-speaking congregation. They should learn English. And yet that wasn't spread. It wasn't used as a wedge to drive the two groups apart. So I was kind of pleased with what was going on in space entirely.
Did you ever try to analyze why it worked there and evidently doesn't work in other places?
I thought about it. I wouldn't want to reach any conclusions. I thought along economic lines. I thought along objectives that the more Cuban population wants to accomplish here in the United States. I think that the Cubans that are living in Miami are a little bit more similar as far as values to more people of a more Caucasian background. but I really wanted to make any conclusions. It just was working.
The mindset of the Cuban is very much alike to the mindset of the Anglo. They are striving people, a hard-working people, a stubborn people, and they should get along very well. That's the reason. No, very simply, that's the reason. Your Mexican-American will be a more docile individual, very submissive. It takes a long time for that individual to exert himself, to assert himself, and to take on a dominant role in a particular group. Consequently, to bring, and this is part of the sensitivity that I mentioned before, to bring two groups together, you better be very careful as to what you're dealing with, because you could be killing one at the expense of the other. There are basically three different models that apply. Number one, the one where you have the two congregations or the two groups working as one congregation. One constitution, one organization, with a mixture of two people, like what you had in Miami with Gene Gruhl, in Hialeah with Linky, and now they are experimenting with the St. Andrews in Hialeah with Orozco. Okay. Then you have the model of the two congregations using the same facility, but keeping two separate organizations. This has been rather successful to a point. After a while, the one group will begin to complain because the walls are getting dirty and the books don't get put back and you can't keep the place clean and they left the lights on and they left the shower running and this, and before you know it, chaos. The other one is where you have two separate facilities for two separate congregations, which is what you had down there in Texas, and this one, for the vast majority of the people, works the best. And simply because the vast majority of the Hispanics in this country are either Mexican-Americans or Mexican. And then, of course, that little subgroup that we call Chicano. Okay? Well, there is a big difference. Chicano, in a very simplistic way of putting it, a Chicano is a Mexican-American that has been here for one or more generations. Okay, it's a second or third or fourth or fifth generation Mexican-American who has discovered himself through the educational process. 9 times out of 10, he is a well-educated individual, and as a result of that has become very aware and very politically minded, where he is out to get what he can, and he's not going to stop. Okay. Back in the 60s, we had a lot of marches and, you know, riots and so on and so forth. Today, they are a lot quieter. They're using their intellect more than anything else. But they are striving for positions of mayor and position of governor and Washington positions and anything that will give them the political power that they feel they need in order to maintain a level with the Anglo. So you have those three models. You have to be very careful as to which one you apply, because depending upon the people that you're dealing with, that is what will determine what will be needed. With the Cuban, you can mix them together and they'll never kill each other, because they'll just fight each other and fight each other, but they'll never have, nothing will ever happen. One is just as strong as the other one. If you're dealing with Puerto Ricans, you find out that they are, again, quiet, very submissive, and they are very easily dominated. Your Mexican-American, your Mexican, the one that comes here, for the most part, also is very easily dominated. So they become threatened as soon as you bring them into a predominantly Anglo congregation. They take a back seat, they don't do anything, and they just won't react, period. If you put them by themselves, they'll be great. But when you stick them with a very strong, dominant group, it won't work. Your Chicano, he's a breed all unto himself. That one you can mix, you can do anything you want with it, and he'll manage it. Okay, so this is pretty much what you have. So this is part of the sensitivity that the individual has to gain.
Do you have anyone else questions? If not, we would encourage first of all, if you are interested in getting your name on a list of some kind, we're not asking for it. Not issuing any calls today, but if you would like to be known as one who's interested, even if you're San Juan at this point, we're getting to the point ultimately where we'd like to identify people in the San Juan year. This is another matter that has been discussed. Intimated some things that even here in the seminary education, we ought to make some arrangements. It has been discussed. Nothing is engraved in stone yet. What we're thinking is that we would identify people in the first year and find some way of beginning language studies at that time. We have two people who are sort of in that category now. One will be taking advanced Spanish at Washington University, and another one taking more elementary Spanish at Forest Park Community College. The time may come when we will be able to offer that here on campus, but that's part of the plan that we have in mind. Then the next step, having stayed in contact with these people throughout the first and second year and gotten some language study in, would be obviously at least a 12-month vicarage in a Hispanic situation. Possibly longer, and we've even thought in terms of a double situation where you'd spend a part of a year, maybe 8 months in one place, and then move to another one to get the different anthropological interests in. And then the fourth year would be, you know, what we've been struggling with is to make sure that anyone who gets into this program will have the valid MDiv. We don't want to interfere with that program at all. But to add to it and to look ahead long enough so that certain electives could be used, and then we would be able to supply courses in cultural anthropology particularly, maybe some history, and possibly even the SEM 4 homiletics elective, which will be required, I guess, of everybody who starts in SEM 1 this year. That could be in the area of at least partially Hispanic preaching and so on, so that when you finished, you would have an MDiv and you would be trained adequately to enter a ministry anywhere, and yet at the same time you have special training and guidance toward Hispanic ministry. None of this is on paper, but none of it has been passed yet, and we're still taking a look at it. If you have any ideas in that regard, we'd like to know. I think it's important from the student point of view to realize that there are a lot of people with different interests who say, why don't you train a student for our ministry? And let's pick out a man and train him to be a Hispanic pastor to Hispanics. And then you can find probably 10 or 12 separate interests. The concern of the faculty is, number one, the student, that you are trained to be a pastor. And then in addition, if we can identify special interests early enough and can supply a specific flavor to it without injuring your regular MDiv program, then we'd like to do that. But it's a constant tension there. Because if supposing we really go gung-ho and we train you to be in Hispanic ministry, and you spend a year there and you don't like it, you just don't fit, and that can happen. Oh, and now what? Now where do you go? You have been shortchanged. So it's that kind of tension we're working with. Okay, any comments or questions? If not, yes, please.
I do have a question. A couple months ago, we had somebody else from Board of Missions here. I think it was. You were talking about the goal of the convention set out all these churches were going to plant. You mentioned 50 in the next year.
No, next,
in the next decade.
Right.
Nice the next year. And I'm wondering just what we mean by churches. When I think of church, I think, you know, my home church, we've got 500 communicants and so on, or my Vicarage congregation, 1,000 communicants. Is that what we're talking about here? Or are we talking about a house church of 25 people?
What is your definition of the church? What is your definition of the church? Theological definition of the church.
It's when and where the sacraments are administered in accordance with the scriptures and the gospel is preached in its purity.
Beautiful. Is there any statement made as to the number of people that must be there to hear it?
Both one to preach and one to hear it.
That's all it takes, right?
Okay.
Now, when we're saying that, we are talking about a number of people gathered around the altar, okay, to hear the word and to celebrate the sacraments. We are very much sold and interested in a word and sacrament ministry. Our concept is that any social work or anything else is to flow out of that. Okay, so when we are talking about church planting, it could be a preaching station, maybe not necessarily an organized congregation of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that is self-sustaining and so on and so forth. It most probably will be a mission station, which is being assisted from, you know, with the district, with a subsidy, and that has its own pastor taking care of the word and the sacraments on a regular basis. That is what we're talking about. Which is just as much a congregation as far as the Lord is concerned, and is just as much the church as far as the Lord is concerned.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Let me give you an example. I went to Racine, Wisconsin, not particularly known for being a stronghold of Hispanics. The total population was about 7,500, roughly, Hispanics. I started in 1970 by order of the district. The first couple of years, really, nothing much happened. I spent about a year and a half, really, becoming acquainted with the community and letting the community get acquainted with me. After that time, we had been able to get some Bible study started in the homes, you know, this kind of thing, and the people were asking for worship. So I went to the district. They said, okay, let's go. And we used the facilities of a Slovak congregation, of all places, and we started worship services. When I left, which was March of this year, in January we were organized as the congregation with 81 or 83 members, baptized members. Okay? Now that to me is a valid congregation. Certainly, economically, it cannot hold its own. But if you continue to get a concerned pastor to continue to work in that area, it'll grow. And you will have a congregation, hopefully, that eventually will become self-sustaining and that will also help other congregations go. Now, we had, because we started from scratch, we had the opportunity to get something done that I had been thinking about for a long time, and that this district bought into 1,000%. It helped the district and it helped us. I was convinced, and I'm still convinced, that we do a disservice to the people when we load them down with a tremendous debt you are only going to bring problems and discontent and headaches and heartaches and everything else. So the agreement was, leave us alone. We'll get going, and as we grow, we will, you know, acquire those things that we need. So we started by using the facilities of Pentecost Lutheran Church, which is a Slovak congregation. We were there for about 2 years. After that, we had the need to buy a building. So we went back to the district. We bought a very small building. It seats 100 or so. Okay? It was owned by Jehovah's Witnesses. We bought it from them. And as a congregation, then, we went into that building. The district paid the purchase price. We entered into a contract with the district to pay back the district, both principal and interest. Okay? Then we moved into the building, and we tore everything apart, and we started from scratch. We turned it into a church, as we envision it. Jehovah's Witnesses, the Kingdom Hall, has nothing in it, just a bunch of chairs and a lectern and microphones and loudspeakers and this kind of stuff, for pep rallies more than anything else. We needed an altar, we needed a lectern, we needed a pulpit, we needed a cross, we needed all kinds of things. We made everything ourselves, the pulpit, the lectern, the cross, even the baptismal font we made. Okay? We paneled upstairs, downstairs, everything ourselves. We paid for everything. The district didn't put out one single cent. All this time, we were contributing to the district roughly about 17% for missions, over and above what we had to pay for the mortgage and the interest and principal on the mortgage. In addition to that, this group was supplying all of its needs. They paid the electric, they paid the gas, they paid for Bibles, hymnals, anything that they had to buy, and they paid for it. The district never put out one single cent aside from my salary. That is still in effect. The only thing that the district is putting out is the salary of the pastor. That congregation still pays for everything itself. And it is a happy congregation. I just spent a delightful week with them around Christmas time. And they are a happy group. They are a dedicated group. And I can tell you stories that will really warm your heart about those people. It's beautiful. So what we're talking about is, you know, how many people do you need? It's hard to say. If they are willing to support themselves and the preaching of the word and the celebration of the sacraments and everything that goes with it, let them go. That's it. And I don't care if you have 10. If they can do that, that's fine. May I make an announcement before I forget? I should have done this earlier before half the crowd left. But I am going to be back here on the 12th of next month. I think you have a solemn meeting on this, what is it, the second Tuesday of the month? On the 12th, okay. I will be here again to, you know, talk with you guys and anything that you might, any questions you might have or anything, and try to address myself to perhaps other things that I didn't mention here and so on. I could talk for hours. Yeah. That's...